From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made this past Saturday when hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of Washington, D.C. to march for gun control legislation. The demonstration was one of more than 800 around the world, including one here in Rochester, largely led by students and young people who wanted to say, enough is enough with gun violence. The march in Washington was organized in part by the survivors of the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where a gunman killed 17 people. The weekend demonstrations are the latest in a series of movements in our country where activists are pushing for change, from the women's movement to Black Lives Matter to Occupy Wall Street, and back to anti-Vietnam War protests and the civil rights movement. Our nation has a history of activism. This hour, we'll discuss that activism and if these types of demonstrations are effective in bringing change. Will the March for Our Lives lead to stricter gun laws? What will come of the women's marches and Black Lives Matter? And what have we learned from our past? I'd like to welcome my guest for the hour. Reverend Mike Mullen is the Minister for Youth and Discipleship at Asbury First United Methodist Church, who led a group of 12 young people to the March for Our Lives in Washington this weekend. Welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hannah Beamish is one of those students that attended the march. She's a junior at Webster Thomas High School. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Shalinda Bolar is the Associate Coordinator for Teen Empowerment, and she participated in the March for Our Lives here in Rochester. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you.
Lintori Johnson is an activist and the mother of Johnny Johnson, one of the victims of the shooting outside the Boys and Girls Club shooting in 2015. Welcome back to the program, Lintori.
Thank you so much.
And Bob Good is a longtime activist who participated in a number of demonstrations over many years, including a raid on the draft board in Camden, New Jersey during the Vietnam War. Welcome back to you.
Thank you, Megan.
Listeners, we want to make it clear that our goal this hour is to discuss the potential of mass demonstrations and their history. So some of you are already weighing in about this past weekend's marches, and that's great. We do want to hear from you, but just a reminder that the focus of the conversation this hour will cover broad territory. It's not just about gun laws per se. It's about whether such large-scale demonstrations can be effective at making change. So we want to know what you think. You can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. Tell us what your experience has been, if you think protests achieve change, or maybe you agree with some critics who say they're a waste of time. So let us know what you think. So to kick things off, I'd like to turn to Hannah. Since you were at the march in Washington, what was your experience there?
It was an incredible display of power of what the youth and even the adults can bring to our country. 800,000 plus people all gathered in one place to share a common message or common ideals and to kind of say we are fed up with walking into a classroom and thinking, where would I go in a lockdown right now?
What led you to want to participate in that? Was it your church was organizing something? Did you talk to other kids at school?
I was interested in going before. I knew that we had an organized trip. I was talking to my friends at school. We shared similar opinions on the matter, and I thought that it would be really incredible to think that this will be part of history and I can be there.
In your personal opinion and those of your colleagues, what are you hoping to accomplish with this march?
I am hoping to accomplish, ideally, a complete ban on assault rifles in the hands of civilians.
Are you optimistic?
I am. In this current political climate, I'm not really sure, but I have hope that we'll keep fighting.
Reverend Mullen, you and your colleagues at the church decided to chaperone members of your youth ministry. Were there many who came forward to you and said, hey, we want to go, how can you help us? Or what led you to organize that trip?
Right after the Parkland shooting happened, we had a youth approach myself and some of our other pastors on staff and ask how we as pastoral leaders in our church might support the youth and their decisions to participate in the walkouts and the demonstrations we have seen. And part and parcel with that conversation and further conversations with youth, we thought, you know, we're only 6.5 hours away from Washington, D.C. How incredible of an opportunity is this to be able to take a bunch of youth down to D.C. and have that experience? And so we had some connections with the United Methodist Church. We were able to stay overnight Friday night and then stay till Saturday. And everything just came together, and the youth were excited to be able to be a part of it and to make sure that their voices were heard.
As a faith-based organization, are you concerned with what some critics are saying and that this is very politically charged? What is your role as a faith-based organization? And if you look at the words of Pope Francis over the weekend, do you fall more along the lines of that, let's give youth a voice, or do you have any concerns about any of the political implications?
As a Protestant, I would definitely affirm Pope Francis's words this weekend to make sure that we remember that the youth have a voice. They are our present. They are not simply our future. And as a pastor, a minister for youth and discipleship, part of my role is to continue to advocate for the youth and to help provide opportunities and experiences where their voices can be heard. And so whereas there are aspects of this that people understand as political, we tend to, as a church, approach it as humanitarian, human rights. As a church, we are speaking for the betterment of all people and what we can do to protect all people. And with our youth speaking out, that's what we want to support.
Shalinda, you participated in the march here in Rochester. What was the experience like for you?
I thought that the experience was very powerful. It gave us the opportunity to tell the narrative of urban city youth because it indeed is very different than our neighboring surrounding
suburbs.
So it was very powerful just to see many voices, like many different perspectives coming together at one place to speak on this issue, because it indeed like affects me very personally. I lost two people very close to me in that triple homicide shooting, and it's right down the street from my job, you know. So just to tell our story and, you know, explain to people that this is very real and it happens in other parts of, you know, our communities, but it happens almost every day in mine. So I think it was very powerful to just share that part.
There's some criticism of the women's movement and the women's march in particular about it not being inclusive of all voices, and there's a lack of intersectionality in the organization. Do you feel like the March for Our Lives is handling that better than the women's march did? Or maybe you disagree. Maybe you feel like the women's march was inclusive. But from your perspective, do you think we're moving in the right direction in terms of including more people?
I believe that we are. I think it just starts with a dialogue. I feel like we all have to sit down and be willing to listen to other people's opinions and their stories first before we judge anybody. So I think it is moving in a very positive direction. I feel like we're going uphill. It may take some time, but I feel like it's a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. Lentori Johnson, you gave a powerful speech at the Rochester rally. We were discussing it before the hour began. And you're particularly speaking to parents, saying, look at what our children are doing. And I know that your life has been changed dramatically, and we are so sorry for your loss. How has what has happened changed your life and led you to pursue this path of activism?
Oh, from the moment almost I lost JR, I had to find a way to channel the hurt, the rage, the sorrow that I felt in my child being taken the way he was. Yeah, to me, it made no sense. Not only did he lose his life, but that the method, the weapon that was utilized on the night of those murders could even be in any individual hand. To me, that was just mind-boggling in itself. And I'm gonna tell you, it was a process. It was a process for me, because first I had to absorb the fact that I'd lost him. Then I had to plan, and I thank God for youth, because it was the youngest individuals of my family. Had it not been for them, I really don't know how I would have got through it, because they were all hands on preparing for his funeral. And so whatsoever I wanted, they were instrumental in helping me to make sure it would happen. And it's like I shared with the audience, anyone who attended JR's funeral, there was a mandate, and I know God gave it. Because on every pallbearer shirt that was at their funeral, they wore this message. And it was commit, take back our neighborhoods, organize, do something. Do something was in essence the message that went forward. And I was so uplifted Saturday. I mean, really, between watching the youth on TV to arriving at Washington Square to see the children, the young people who participated that day, it was an affirmation for me that change will come. Change will come. And I'm not like most of the adults. I believe it's going to be sooner than most people will want to believe. I do believe that. I really believe that.
What do you think JR would be thinking if he were here, watching you participate in this activism and spreading this message that's so important to you?
You know, for people who lost, who knew JR, you know, when I tell people this, and it's all I can say to you about JR, I hope he would be proud of me. When I talk to him, and I still do, I hope I make him proud. And I asked a few things of the Lord in my prayers. And one of the things I asked for was the heart of my child, because JR was fierce. He really was. Strong opinion, able to stand up for himself. Sometimes, like parents do, I try to pull him back, but he was always that way. And I think God granted me that. You know, I tell people, I'm like anybody, I'm human. Sometimes I'm afraid, but I don't live in fear. There's no fear in me. You know, afraid is a thing we all deal with sometimes. But I really believe that that's the Lord giving me my wish to let me be a channel for my child.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for your beautiful speech over the weekend. Thank you all for being here, because when we talk about demonstrations and protests, I think there's often a tendency to focus on numbers. How many people showed up? How many people were marching? But that doesn't necessarily translate to success. But I think one of the things that may further causes is the passion and the hope behind them, like what you've just discussed, Lentori. And Bob, over the past few decades, as you've participated in many marches and many demonstrations, you have your own personal story when you became an activist during Vietnam. And I know your mother was actively involved in that too. Can you speak to the heart of being an activist and why you think that might make a difference?
The passion, I think, is one of the very important pieces. In my particular case, my brother was drafted out of high school, and 6 weeks after he was sent to Vietnam, he was killed in action. And it was obviously a very devastating time for all of us in the family, and obviously and particularly my parents, but all of us, as, of course. And a few years later, I had an opportunity to participate in a draft board action in Camden, New Jersey. And we were arrested. And during the trial, my mother came to speak and had just an amazingly powerful, testimony about, you know, her two sons, one of whom was killed in the war and the other was on trial. And I think one of the things when I was listening here to Hannah and talking about JR and realizing the passion that's here now, that one of the parallels is that it's so close to home. That in the one of the things that I find difficult at times to explain to people about Vietnam who weren't there or maybe of a different generation and weren't, you know, growing up at that time, was that the fact of the draft made it a personal issue for everybody. You had to do something. You had to respond in some way, whether it was go in, whether it was evade, whether it was get a deferment, whether it was protest. But it was personal. And that had an effect on our society as a whole. And what I see happening now with these young people and hearing them talk about being the mass shooting generation and knowing that kids today go to school, like you said, Hannah, where would I hide? What would I do? We go through lockdown drills. Mm-hmm. That's a new reality. Mm-hmm. And what the current generation is experiencing touches them right to the core. And it is what I think inspires the passion that we saw over this weekend and will, I believe, continue to see. Mm-hmm. And I think it will make a difference.
When we look at the March for Our Lives, we're seeing some changes already. And there are many sources online that say Parkland is different. Parkland is different than other instances of mass shootings and the patterns that we often see after those shootings happen. Jeet Herr for The New Republic wrote last month, he said, quote, "As horrifying as they are, mass shootings in America have become commonplace enough to be ritualized. They start with the breaking news and the steady rising casualty count, followed by speculation about the nature of the killer. Is he a terrorist? Is he or she mentally ill? And then calls for stricter gun control and counter calls for more permissive laws. After people rehearse their same tired positions, it becomes clear that Congress won't act. The debate soon ends. Silence ensues until the next mass shooting," end quote. But again, people are saying this time is different. Hannah, why do you think this demonstration may be different?
I believe that in the past mass shootings that we've had in this country, in Sandy Hook, the children were so young, they did not have the power, they did not have the anger and the words to describe and to shout out into the community what they felt against the assault on their classmates, Columbine. They did not have the intense social media network and access that we do today. And my generation, we are going to utilize that as much as we possibly can. And we are not afraid to stand up to their government right now.
We're seeing some change in Florida already, especially after the students in Parkland have been so active. The Florida legislature has a new gun law that raises the age to buy a rifle to the age of 21. That law also introduces a 3-day waiting period on gun sales and increases state funding for mental health services. I'm seeing some feedback already coming in about the importance of voter registration. Hannah, are you hearing from fellow students about the importance of registering to vote?
Yes. When we were in the protest, you would see about every 4 feet someone who was waiting to register you to vote. And I think that's incredibly important. We cannot stand by and watch people from past generations decide our futures for us.
Shalinda, how do you feel about that when you work with the students who are part of Teen Empowerment? Do they realize how much they have a voice if they register to vote? Or is that something that do you think this generation needs more education on?
Well, I know that our youth at Teen Empowerment, we emphasize the importance of voting because they know that they have a voice in these issues, and we try to get them to use their voices in any way possible to influence or impact any institutional change or anything that we can do to kind of swindle what's going on now, like change the hearts and minds of people. I think that voter registration is not publicized or, you know, highly televised in any way to our young people. So I know a lot of young people on the streets that don't think voting is even important, or just people in their houses, they don't usually vote. So it's not that important to them. But I know that we try to explain the importance of it, because we see, as we see now, like our president, like, you know, he's not the best in my opinion. But just the importance of, like, if you do vote, you have a voice and you can change, or you can impact the change in our state, in our country, in our city. And it just starts with you.
The students who organized the March for Our Lives in Washington partnered with an organization called Headcount. It's a nonpartisan organization that registers young voters at concerts and other events. And they said that they registered about 4,800 people across the country on Saturday, and they're still receiving applications in the mail. The League of Women Voters in New York State said they registered 150 people just in New York. And NBC News is reporting that if every graduating senior were to register, that would be 3.6 million new voters this coming graduation season. But they also report that traditionally young people don't register, and if they do, they don't typically vote. So Hannah, if you were in a room with your peers and some of them weren't registered or some were, and they thought, you know, my voice doesn't really matter, my one vote won't count, what would you say to them?
I would say that I know it's difficult with the Electoral College and feeling like the popular vote does not count, especially with the outcome of this past election. But I would tell them to keep hope, because our school does place a high emphasis on registering for the past election. There are announcements near the end of the school year. If you will be 18 in the next election, please vote, because we really do emphasize that you think that you can't change the world on your own, but without you, we couldn't do it. Without each person, nothing would happen.
Here's an email from a listener named Lisa who would like to talk about voter registration. She says, I wanted to mention that 17-year-olds can register to vote if their 18th birthday is before the day of the general election in November. She says she hasn't seen that referenced anywhere as young people have been demonstrating. So an email there from Lisa, thank you. And that goes back to what you were saying, Shalinda. Maybe young people aren't hearing enough about how to register to vote. Maybe the media is not doing a good enough job about the importance of civic engagement. Maybe schools aren't. Lentori, do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think schools need to have a more active role in civics?
Absolutely. Because I know it's different from suburban schools to city schools. And the best example is just like Celine, you know, she's saying, more education, more hands-on. You and I are from a generation where we walked the beat. We learned early. We went to the people. We not only went to them to get them registered, we were instrumental oftentimes, at least when I had youth behind me, where we picked people up, got people to the voting polls. And whenever I have the opportunity, and I do, because every week I'm at the rec centers, I emphasize to the children that I have the opportunity to be with how important that is, how you have to understand. If it wasn't important, then why are they trying to take it from us? Why are they doing everything they can to redistrict, imbalance, the way the American public can be allowed to vote. So this is what I see, where age and experience should be talking to the youth. See, because youth has something. They have their youth. They have a zeal. And I tell people, I said, but age has wisdom. We have knowledge of how to accomplish certain things. And you can blend those things. And everybody, therefore, has a seat at the table, so to speak. But I love these babies, because they're not accepting breadcrumbs. From the youngest speakers to the oldest ones of the senior ones that spoke. I love that about them. They're saying, don't throw me some breadcrumbs.
Bob, what do you think is different about this generation?
Well, as I said, I think that any of us that aren't from that generation, I just don't think we can comprehend what these folks are experiencing in terms mm-hmm. of, in particular, this issue of gun violence. But another point, you know, which is the earlier question you started with that I think is important and touches on your thought as well, is the history that protests, speaking out, civil disobedience, the history that has in our country. Very often people denigrate activities by whether it's young people or many people. Mm-hmm. But it's really our country was founded on that. We were founded on stepping apart, on civil disobedience, on protesting. From the Boston Tea Party and John Peter Zengler and the Free Press to the Fugitive Slave Acts and the people that assisted to, the unions, everybody mm-hmm. that out there that has a good working job now, many of those roots are rooted in the struggles of unions. So this generation is taking the torch from another generation. But there have been countless generations over the centuries, really, that have spoken to this, and it needs to continue on and keep going.
Absolutely.
Reverend Mullins, what do you think? What are you seeing among the youth that you work with at your church?
I think there's a lot of outrage. There's a lot of articulation that we see, as Hannah mentioned, with this generation and their connection with social media and their ability to make sure their voices are heard and not silenced or swept under the carpet or anything like that. But they're able to continue this conversation beyond their schools, beyond their hallways, and take it out into the public and through viral marketing that we find ourselves in today, force it upon us, whether news agencies or anything will pick it up. It will still be in our news feeds when we log on online and other places. And so with that, we see a momentum that's carried through with March for Our Lives and these continued movements that has struggled in past issues. One of the things that stood out to me in D.C. was the student that talked about the agency he started after Sandy Hook when he was 11 years old, and he has continually been an advocate for this. And here he is, how many years later, continuing to advocate for it. But here and now, we have a way that we don't have to just be pushed to the side. We can continue to have our voices be at the forefront, and that's the difference that I think our youth today are making and will continue to make.
I'd like to highlight something that references something that Hannah brought up. When we talk about how the March for Our Lives may be different, she mentioned this generation has a strong voice, they have more resources, they're very effective with social media. But I'd like to ask questions about who can participate in these demonstrations, because research shows that those who are more wealthy have more access to participate in protests. So a 2004 report by American Political Science Association says that citizens with low or moderate income levels speak with a whisper that is lost on the ears of inattentive government, while the advantaged roar with the clarity and consistency that policymakers readily heed. So they're looking at wealth inequality and whose voices are heard. And then looking at a study from 2002 from political scientist Larry Bartels, he says, compared to their lower income counterparts, wealthy Americans are more likely to have access to information about policies and in turn form more sophisticated opinions about those policies. They're also more likely to vote in elections and have direct contact with public officials. They're also more likely to donate to public campaigns. So when we look at this from a broad level, and as everyone from any background would like to participate, but we're seeing inequality in that. How do we address that? How do we make sure that all voices are heard and have equal access?
Well, for me, I don't hold too much for studies. I really don't. I mean, they have their place, but I can't really buy into it, being from the generation I come from, because I look at the fact, and coming from the South, the parents I had, I thought I was rich, later only to find out economically we were at the bottom end. I come from a family of 10 children, and that had a different strata level for all of us. But people from migrant camps, and I came through a migrant camp, started learning even through the civil rights movements what King espoused. And we're talking about him and Robert Kennedy. This is the anniversary periods, you know. So everything has its place, but I still fall back to the fact it's about individual responsibility, being your brother's keepers. Because even when you look at the suburban schools, but what I loved about the children Saturday from Washington and around the world, they didn't let what most of society would say get in the way of their message. It was unified. Because understand this, for all of the mass shootings that they have, we've been losing our children mm-hmm. on a more significant level every day. Yep. And it goes without recognition. Those young people understood that. And they're not letting people divide their message. And I think that's important, that people really emphasize that. What made these babies different this time around? Sandy Hook, not that the voices weren't there, it was the parents' voices who were there. And let me tell you from my own personal experience, believe this. I, because God saw fit to guide the hand of the mortician who would prepare my child for burial, had a chance to see his face restored enough where I could look at his image. Now, I don't personally know how all of those babies were in Sandy Hook, but I would almost dare to say they probably were not open caskets. What happened to my child was God's mercy and grace that he could even survive to get to hospital. So I can't hold to a lot of this stuff. This is all about people. It's about caring. What made Parkland a little different is this. It's suburban school, number one. But here's what those children did. And they do the same thing our children do throughout every neighborhood. They were able to bring us into it. They were in those classrooms. They were on their cell phones. They were videotaping. They exposed us to the horror of what they were feeling, the fear that was in those rooms while they tried to hide, hoping that their lives would not be taken. There's the difference. There's the difference. It forces us to look at what we would otherwise shun or turn away from. And it shouldn't be like that. And I don't know if you watched it last night, but that was part of the King documentary, the media. The media plays a part of what they sometimes downplay or bring up. But those babies, they understood it. Rochester understood it because you saw all of the different voices.
Listeners, you're hearing from Lentori Johnson. She's a local activist and the mother of Johnny Johnson, one of the victims of the shooting outside the Boys and Girls Club in 2015, sharing her stories, her thoughts on activism. Also in studio, Reverend Mike Mullen, the Minister for Youth and Discipleship at Asbury First United Methodist Church. Hannah Beamish, a member of that church and one of the students from Webster who attended the march in Washington this past weekend. Shalinda Bolar is the Associate Coordinator for Teen Empowerment. She participated in the March for Our Lives here in Rochester. And Bob Good, a longtime activist who was very active during the Vietnam War. I know you marched in the Women's March. You were in Rochester this past weekend. So I'm starting to see your phone calls come in and some feedback via Twitter. So we'll take our short break and we'll take your calls. And when we come back also, I'd like to hear from some critics. I have some pushback that I found online. I'd like to see what our guests think about that. So stay with us. More Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, it's the Rochester Reads program back at Writers and Books. Author Reina Grande will join a series of events in Rochester this week to discuss her new memoir, The Distance Between Us. It's a story about her family and how it was ripped apart as her parents and she and her siblings crossed the border into the U.S. from Mexico. It's a conversation about immigration reform and the voices that she thinks are unheard. That's next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the potential impact of protests and mass demonstrations, and the phone lines are lit up, not surprising. So listeners, we'll get to your calls. Try to keep your questions and comments brief because I know our panel has a lot to say and we want to hear from many of you. So first up on the phone is Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Just a quick hello to Bob Good, whom I know, and I just wanted to mention for your audience that Bob and the other 19 co-defendants in Rochester, in the Camden protest, took huge chances because they wouldn't take a plea that the government desperately wanted them to take. So they went to trial, and they were facing a lot of time in prison if they got a guilty plea. And they came out of it. I mean, the government may have had the goods as far as evidence, but they were found not guilty, which is, I think, huge and important, that kind of thing. I've been a peace activist for probably about as long as Bob, and I get jaded at times because when I look at the issues around war and peace, we've had ups and downs, but the general drift over the last 50 years has been down. There's not less money being spent per year on armaments. There's not less saber rattling going on and so forth. It's easy to get discouraged. However, I have seen, even with the Vietnam War protests, which didn't succeed, that those things are a great, they bring hope. And they also change the conversation. Look at the Wall Street protests, where all of a sudden we were focused because the people who organized that made that an issue of the 1% or the 0.1% versus the rest of us. And that made sense to people and mattered. It still matters, even though we're not going in the right direction with that either. But anyway, the comment I want to make is I can't get over the brilliance and intelligence of the young people doing this, because they are so focused and it matters so much. When they talk to Congress, they know how to do that in a way that makes those guys sweat, which is what they need to do. They need to be sweating it out a little bit, because this open prayers and good wishes while accepting money from the NRA, that's just not cutting it anymore. And the students have a way of presenting that that is amazing. And also, what they ask for is really significantly intelligent, because you could say ban all guns, but that's just sort of blather and it's not going to happen, and they're not advocating it. They're advocating really sensible stuff. So my heart and sympathy and well wishes go out to them. I'm going to be participating with them for as long as I can, and I guess that's about it. That's what I want to say.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks so much for calling. Hannah, when you hear from people like Mike who are so proud of what your generation is doing, how do you react to that?
I am really incredibly grateful for the people, because I know that people in past generations tend to be, overall, not everyone, obviously, a bit more close-minded than us. They did not have the access to everything that we do. You open your Twitter feed looking for your friends' tweets, and you will see all the top trending. You learn all the news just in that 1 5 minutes you have. And I am really incredibly grateful for those who are able to use their wisdom and age to stand up for us and work with us, especially the veterans who have shown up at the march.
Bob, I saw you shaking your head during Mike's call. What were you feeling when he was talking about the difference between the Vietnam War and now?
I guess I see almost more, parallels in the fact that now people do have themselves at stake. You know, it might be in a different sense. You're not going to be drafted. You're not facing that, but you're facing something that no other generation has faced. And I think all the adults struggle to begin to comprehend that. I mean, I think we can comprehend that. And I think the other point that you made is about the fact that aside from the mass shootings, teenagers, people across the country, you know, gun violence is happening every single day. People's lives are being lost every single day, far more than are lost in mass shootings. And you know, older folks that are, you know, we didn't grow up with that. We didn't have that as part of our consciousness. We didn't have that as part of our awareness. So the very big differences between the draft and the Vietnam and today, but there's also very strong parallels in a different vein, but that are very much there. And people today, I think, are being impacted by that. That's going to motivate them, as Hannah was talking about so wonderfully.
The focus of our conversation so far when it comes to protests and demonstration have been mass marches, mass demonstrations, many people showing up. But let's not forget to include grassroots activism. And I'd like to bring someone in on the phone now. This is Lindsay Roble. She is a former student of the University of Rochester, who launched her own hunger strike to protest Lindsay, you're joining us now. You were looking for either the termination or Florian Jaeger's professorship to be eliminated.
Yes.
So what led you to go on hunger strike? Hi, thank you for calling.
Having been a part of student government at the University of Rochester and having worked closely with the now former president, Joel Seligman, in some capacities, but also the other administrators, the other deans of the school, sort of understood the way that they viewed students and the way that they understood student activism, and especially, you know, having seen their responses up close in, I think it was 2015, when there's the issue with Yik Yak at the university, and Black students were being threatened with, like, racist threats under the veil of anonymity that the app provided. And the university's response of doing nothing, I knew going into the demonstration portion of this that it likely wouldn't make a difference, and that the administrators likely wouldn't care unless there was something more, which is unfortunate, and I don't think speaks negatively to mass protest, but speaks negatively to that administration, right? So I, you know, after reading the EEOC complaint, saw that one of the professors who was a complainant felt unsafe eating and sleeping in her own home because she'd been, you know, coerced into living with Professor Yeager. And that sort of symbolic aspect of it, as well as seeing the success of other hunger strikes at other universities like Mizzou in, I believe it was also 2015, sort of sparked the idea. And, you know, when we were called in to talk to President Seligman, the first thing he said to me was that he was calling us in and wanted to talk to us because he'd heard that I was going to do a hunger strike, not because he wanted to know, you know, the student's opinion on how it should be handled. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the genesis of how that happened.
So, Lindsay, I'm sure you heard from people, whether it was faculty or staff at the university or maybe fellow students, who approached you when they found out about your hunger strike and said, why do you think that one person launching one effort will make a difference? What did you say to critics who came to you with some of those statements?
Yeah, and that was something that I got a lot of questions about, right, was you're one person, like, why do you think they're going to listen? And, you know, it was partially that I knew the administration and had been told that they were concerned about it, but it was also because I'm someone who's a firm believer that your voice is one of the most powerful tools you have. You can institute so much change just by being a loud college kid with some poster board, right? And I don't think that that's always the case for everybody. I think that I was incredibly lucky in that I was a white girl who was perceived very differently by the administration, and whose protest was taken very differently by the administration than I may have been if I was a student of color or if I was, like, visibly disabled or something, right? But I do think that I want to believe in the idea that one voice and one person can make change if they try hard enough and if they believe in what they're doing. And I did and still do believe that what I did was the right thing and I would do it again. So it was for me a matter of sort of encouraging people to reach within themselves and find their own voice and speak or act in a way that was meaningful to them. 'Cause that's really all I did, was do what felt right to me at the time. And I think that's all anyone can do.
Lindsay, I want to thank you for calling and offering that perspective, because as I mentioned before, it's important to keep different kinds of activism in mind. We're not always talking about marches or protests, but individual efforts to try to make change and individual responsibility. So thank you for calling. I know we got to let you go, but I appreciate it. And good luck to you. You're in Washington now, correct?
I am. I was actually at the march yesterday and it was amazing.
Oh, that's so great. Well, thank you so much for calling in, and we'll be sure to keep posted on what you're doing. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. I'd like to turn to my guest because there's some criticism online about the recent efforts and those of the past. And I'll start with this. This is from The Atlantic in 2014. It says, quote, aerial photos of the anti-government marches routinely show an intimidating sea of people furiously demanding change. And yet it's surprising how little these crowds achieve. The fervent political energy on the ground is hugely disproportionate to the practical results of these demonstrations. And then later it says, quote, What we've witnessed in recent years is the popularization of street marches without a plan for what happens next and how to keep protesters engaged and integrated in the political process. It's just the latest manifestation of the dangerous illusion that it is possible to have democracy without political parties, and that street protests based more on social media than sustained political organizing is the way to change society. End quote. I'll turn to Bob, because I think of all of our guests here, you have the most experience with participating in activism over the years. What do you make of that? Do you agree or disagree?
Well, a couple things. One thing is, and Hannah mentioned this again about the march, one of the differences, and you did as well, Mrs. Johnson, that there is a much more active push for engagement. You know, you said every 4 feet there was a table to get people registered, and you go to the city center, and Teen Empowerment, I know you mentioned as well, works very hard to make sure that people find this thread and stay with it and do get engaged. But I think there is also a place for the strong voices, for the people gathering in the quote-unquote, you know, town square. You know, Vietnam, one march certainly did not change the course of the war, but I don't think there's any doubt that as that built up and as people became more and more engaged, both in small levels and large levels and protest after protest, that affected the course of the war. And I think it can now as well. So it certainly isn't that a march out there by itself is a single entity and that is supposed to have all this effect. But it provides an impetus, it provides a voice that other people can see and respond to, and now it can also provide that connection to get people engaged.
This is Isaac on Twitter saying, as a social worker involved in local and national organizing for the New Poor People's Campaign, mass demonstrations can have an impact, but there has to be ongoing organization and movement building to affect and sustain change. Hannah, what do you think about that as you look toward what's next for the students who are involved in the March for Our Lives?
What's next is we really have established our forefront speakers like Emma Gonzalez. We had for anyone who viewed the march in D.C., we had a video submission by Malala. We had members of the U.S. Army and Navy who spoke over video about their weapons and how they felt about how that would end up in civilian hands and what use that would have or disuse that would have. And I really think that with this organization, with these, we will not forget these people. This has really hurt everyone. We have seen through social media, through news, I read an article called "This is what a 14-year-old victim of a school shooting leaves behind in her room." We will not forget Jamie Guttenberg. We won't forget about this. We have continued organization. We have the support of higher-ups. We have the support of celebrities, of congressmen. We have all that we can do, and we're going to keep fighting until we get change.
We're down to our last couple minutes, listeners, and your feedback keeps pouring in. I'm going to try to summarize it as best I can so we hear as many of your voices as possible. There's some criticism about the Women's March not being effective, and that came from a writer online who was pushing back to a piece written by Eric Loomis. Eric Loomis was writing about America's history of activism, and this particular reader said that he recalls massive worldwide protests against Bush's Iraq invasion, and that did, quote, absolutely nothing to slow it down. Similarly, the huge women's march in January 2017 did nothing to slow down Trump and the Republicans, end quote. So Eric Loomis decided he wanted to write a response piece, and he said in that the women's march did accomplish a number of things. First, and in it, perhaps, well, no, secondly, he said, a surge in first-time candidates, women running for office. And if we look at some of those numbers, it looks like that, according to Time magazine, the number of Democratic women likely challenging incumbents in the U.S. House of Representatives is up nearly 350% from 41 women in 2016. So as Hannah was saying, perhaps we won't accomplish the type of gun legislation your group is looking for, but there are indirect, tangible effects that are happening, and that's something that all of our guests have echoed today. I know some of you have questions about the Vietnam War, but I'd like to end with turning back to each guest and just saying what your hopes for the future are in terms of tangible hopes, because it's easy to talk in platitudes and say, You know, we want change. But what does change look like to you, Shalinda?
In my opinion, I think change is just like the inclusion of all people, validating everybody's opinions and their stories, and realizing that for some people, these gun issues are a very real thing. It's a reality for a lot of people in communities of color, especially. And just realizing that you're not alone, right? Everybody has somebody behind them. Strength comes in numbers. And there are organizations like Teen Empowerment, In Control, Metro Justice. There are people out here that are willing to help you and will stand by you.
Lentori, 10 seconds. I know that's not enough.
It's enough for me. I tell the children, stay your course. Many are going to come and try to diminish your message, your efforts, but these children had not only march, they have a plan. I don't march arbitrarily or go to every event that's out there, because always my question when I'm invited is, you march, what we gonna do now? And if I don't hear a plan, I'm not included. These babies have a plan. It's different.
Thank you so much. We are out of time, listeners, but thank you so much for your questions. We'll continue these conversations. My thanks to all our guests. Stay with us for more Connections.